That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Now, you want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
I know newspapers backward, forward, and sideways. I can write them, edit them, print them, wrap them, and sell them.
Don't need anybody right now.
I can handle big news and little news. And if there's no news, I'll go out and bite a dog.
I won't be biting any dogs. Good morning, I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Sharon. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. While most of America shivered in the grips of the polar vortex in Seattle, and especially at Seattle City Hall, things were hot. On Monday, new Mayor Ed Murray and new Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant were sworn in. And if you were expecting Socialist Alternative Party member Sawant to transform herself into a bureaucrat, well, you'd be wrong.
In this system, the market is God, and everything is sacrificed at the altar of profit.
Oh. Designed to stir up, Mayor Ed Murray gave a gentler inaugural address, and then 2 days later, he landed his own definitive punch to business as usual. He demoted the interim police chief and named his own man. Here once again to talk over some of the week's spicy top stories, our esteemed panel of journalists. And this is alphabetical news analyst Joni Balter, Knut Berger, the Moss back at crosscut.com, and Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. It's nice to see you all again.
Good to see you.
Good morning. At least you didn't call us steamed.
Not well, were you steamy? It's hard to know where to start with Seattle politics, so let's be chronological about it. Let's just start Monday, which was the official inauguration. Although I think Murray had already been sworn in, if I'm not mistaken, he had already taken
more quietly sworn in to just make the transition. But then this was the celebration and the official.
This was such a big inauguration that they moved it to the big lobby at Seattle City Hall. They had, by some estimates, more than 1,000 people. Why? This sounds like Passover. Why is this inauguration different from every other? What was different about this one?
Well, we had a couple of big high-profile events going on. We had the first socialist in many, many years being inaugurated to her position as a city council member. And then we had the city's first gay mayor, and if I'm not mistaken, the nation's first gay married mayor, all of this occurring. So they invited their friends. There was some sign waving. And there was a little heat in the room as to sort of who believes in the $15 minimum wage more than whom and who's pressuring whom. And it was just kind of a, really, guys? You're all sort of on the same side here. You know, you got to pull the fist down a little bit. You got to hold the hands and you got to, like, you know, make this work.
Well, before we talk about the lack of kumbaya or the pretense of kumbaya, which Knut wrote a great column about, I want to talk about Ed Murray as the first gay, or at least the first openly gay mayor in Seattle. Knut, you may know more. You know all about mayor history. Maybe we had gay mayors before this one. But
well, if we did, we didn't know.
We didn't know about it.
No openly gay.
No openly gay.
What kind of significance in 2014 does it have that Ed Murray's an openly married gay mayor?
Well, I don't think it has much significance to the people of Seattle in the sense in general, in that I don't think it's the first thing you think of when you think of Ed Murray necessarily. You think of somebody who's been a longtime politician in Olympia, somebody who's widely respected. So I think it's really fascinating that but it's significant in one sense in that it's one of the things responsible for his victory in terms of him being able to attract, by virtue of his role in the gay marriage referendum, was able to use some of that base to help himself get elected. And it's also, I think, reflective of the fact that his signal political accomplishment, at least that he claims, is getting gay marriage passed and doing that in an incremental piece-at-a-time style.
Now, we heard a bit from Shama Sawant's much more spicy speech. Here's what a bit of what Ed Murray had to say. He talked about Seattle as a city of divisions and his commitment to mend the rifts.
We must be courageous enough to acknowledge
that despite the huge gains we have made towards an equitable city, there is much that still divides us, and we must be brave enough to act to address those divisions.
Okay, that was kind of the theme of the campaign. I'm a uniter. I'm not a divider.
But you also hear him talking about income inequality, which is in his attempt at sort of putting a calmer gloss, I guess, on the same idea. And a lot of what you saw this week was Murray, you know, trying not to be outdone on income inequality.
Well, in fact, last week it was, not this week, he put together his panel that was going to come up with some timeline for getting that $15 minimum wage in place. The panel's to report, I believe, in April, mid-April. Shama Sawant was placed on that panel, and theoretically, they both support the $15 minimum wage. That's about, you know, the top line is where the similarities seem to end.
Well, then came the unfortunate comment that Murray was only doing his executive order to raise the minimum wage for city employees due to pressure from below. Who do you think she's talking about in that? That was kind of wild, because you then end up with the headline from Monday of, you know, Murray talks about, you know, innovation, Sawant raises fist. You know, kind of a contrast there, correct?
But there is pressure from below. She's not wrong. And Murray reacted, I don't know, I think a little, he was maybe a little too touchy about that. He put up that Facebook post saying, you know, I've been working on this same issue for a very long time. I mean, in the end, it's all to the good. Everyone wants to support the $15 minimum wage, and it's just a question of how quickly we get there.
Everybody's sort of on the court and establishing their position. The advisory committee met, and there was a big argument apparently over how many aides you could have in the room and who were they. And some of this centered around a Socialist Party worker who is that Sawant wanted in the room. And so then they agreed that everybody could bring one staff member to take notes. But you have her, Shama Sawant is organizing a rally and a $15 an hour grassroots effort. She's been clear about holding the referendum out as a stick to keep the mayor and, going. He's already getting testy. And
it's been 3 days.
Yeah, it's been 3 days. But he's also saying, I'm not ceding any moral authority to you. I mean, we're going to negotiate this together and talk. But I'm not going to let you get on your high horse. To me, one of the interesting things is, they're already arguing about something they agree on. So what does that mean when they come to something they disagree? Oh, I forgot what I was going to say. I just drew a blank. Go ahead.
Well, I want to go back to one point here about the significance of Ed Murray and 2014. I think it's a big deal that it isn't a big deal that he is the city's first gay mayor. This says something about Seattle or the moment in time that it isn't a big deal. So I thought that was pretty darn interesting. And then whether Ed Murray should or shouldn't have said, I'm the mayor, darn it. I think he should say he's the mayor, darn it.
Well, thank you. I just remembered what I was going to say.
I'm here to serve.
One of the dynamics, and Joni, I think, is coming up to this, is the mayor is not equal. Shama Sawant is one of nine city council people, yet because of the national interest in her.
Right.
And because of her surprise victory and her leadership on this one issue, it's become this kind of, in the first week anyway, this kind of Murray Sawant face-off when, you know, the mayor should be the guy.
Because he's the mayor,
in the
you're
driver's
saying.
Seat. Yeah, in other words, yeah, so to kind of be on equal footing there is kind of interesting. And I'm not sure that strategically is where he wants to be.
But that's what he was saying. He was saying, don't question my motives. I came here in my own way. I'm the mayor. I just issued this executive order. Show a little respect.
Well, you know, that I talked to former Mayor Norm Rice right before Christmas, who says he's stepping out of official jobdom into retirement. But one of the things that he said he hoped to see from Ed Murray was a smooth transition from being a legislator, a lawmaker, into being a leader. And what Rice said he learned about himself making the transition from council member to mayor was that you could know all about the dollars and cents, but people hire managers, they elect leaders.
Right. And I think in that sense, it's good that we're seeing the kind of I'm the mayor, darn it, mm-hmm. side of Ed right. Murray, particularly on police. I think that's where it serves him better than with his face off with Sawant. But he has come in and asserted himself in a very strong way on a number of issues within, how many days into January are we?
10.
Yeah, so
10 days. He's been the mayor for 10 days.
Right. So that is good coming from a legislative body and, you know, a long career as a deliberator.
Now, and also over the summer when I was sitting in the seat more regularly, we talked a lot about the, I believe the word was the mushy campaign that he was running. So he's shed that mushy mantle.
Well, to a degree. So one of the things he has done quite a lot of is name a lot of committees. Mm-hmm. And that's a very careful kind of leadership. It's me and my committee. Do you see all these people? One of them has 43 members. They meet at Safeco Field to fit them all in. But then comes the decisiveness of, he starts before he's officially inaugurated, executive order, and then all this stuff this week with the police.
And so we're going to talk more about the police appointment in a couple of minutes. But before we sort of leave the man and style, this first 10 days in office, Eli, you seem to think this is a good sign, this stepping forward that Murray's doing.
Yes. I mean, particularly with the police, and I guess we'll come back to that.
Well, yeah, but we will in a minute or so.
But they, both inside and outside the department, you want clear leadership. That's what the call has been for. And so it's good for him to step in and show that.
We are talking over the week's news, and it's despite the polar vortex, which has not reached its icy fingers here, there's a lot going on in the city of Seattle and in the state of Washington. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger, Joni Balter, news analyst at large, Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut, blogging at Seattle Magazine. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. Police coming up. This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher, and our esteemed panel of journalists have nobody who can replace them. We are here with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, and Knute Berger. And before that last break, we were talking about the mayor and the sort of initial face-off with Kashama Sawant, for I don't know what the term is. But one thing that happened Wednesday, official inauguration Monday, Murray had already been at work. On Wednesday, holds a news conference and announces that he's replacing one interim police chief with his own interim police chief. Jim Pugel is demoted, I guess, to a deputy chief. And Harry C. Bailey, a retired assistant chief, is brought back to hold the place until such time as somebody else is hired.
And this is largely because Pugel really, really, really wants to be police chief. And Murray has laid down this rule, which makes a lot of sense, mm-hmm. that we can't have someone within the department essentially running for the job. It just creates all kinds of bad outcomes and disincentives for people from outside to come to the city because they would have an underling who's really disgruntled if they got it.
And Pugel has said to me in interviews that he did want the job indeed. And so I had heard that as well, Eli. But one of my coworkers said that he had heard Ed Murray say he would not consider anybody at all from the city, that he was really looking outside Seattle. I haven't heard that. Have you?
We've heard intimations of that. I haven't heard that absolutely.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say he has said throughout the campaign that he wanted somebody with experience in transforming a department. And the implication has been it would have to be somebody from outside the department. Well, Pugel is now outside the department and has had some experience in trying to transform the department.
But not very far outside and not very
much. No. I mean, technically, he may meet the thing.
But I think he's still in the department. He's just not the chief.
He's not running anything. So,
well, I think, okay, so the technical reason for replacing Pugel with Harry Bailey, not to be confused with the older brother on It's a Wonderful Life.
Younger brother, because younger? Harry saved that transport because George saved Harry.
Oh, you're right. Okay, there you go. Brother, wow. Nonetheless. But so the technical reason was if Pugel wanted to be considered, he could not be acting chief because that sends a message. Don't forget, we've done this before. And that sends a message that you'll probably pick him to the other candidates. But then you got to listen to the words that the new mayor has been using. And those words do not lead to selecting Pugel.
What do any of you know about Harry C. Bailey?
Very little, except what I've read in the press. And it seems like, although he had a long career at the police department, you know, his post-department life has been security positions that are not exactly running a huge police department. And so I wonder about his experience managing an apparatus as large as the SPD.
One thing that Seattle Times reporter Steve Miletich had written was that this is a man with a lot of reputation for getting along with community groups. We reached out to the NAACP, and the new president of that organization, Gerald Hankerson, had this to say about Harry Bailey.
It seems like a case of just reshuffling the deck but not changing the game. Chief Bailey was a part of the very same leadership team standing in the way of justice when it comes to protecting citizens from unlawful police misconduct in the years past. And at this fragile moment in our reform, Seattle Police Department needs leadership committed to finding solutions, not reverting back to the same old problems.
That's not actually welcome from at least a part of the community that has had issues with SPD.
Well, I've read it both ways. So there's that position, and that exists apparently. But there's also plenty of people who say that Harry Bailey has great connections with the minority community. It's only 4 months, presumably, if the Ed Murray time schedule goes forward. And so we'll just have to see how that works.
You know, I think when you're talking about Ed Murray's leadership, I think making this decision is an example of leadership, and we're going to get to judge whether or not it was a good idea. And it'll be interesting. I thought that Ed Murray sent out a letter this week to the police department.
Yes, he did.
And a
pretty tough worded letter.
Yeah, I mean, the mayor was basically saying this is how it's going to be. You know, we are going to have reform. We're going to do it this way, and everybody needs to get on board. And he was supportive of the police and the police department's mission, but he was making a strong statement about the fact that we're going forward.
And that letter also mentioned that, yes, the police department had been sort of transforming itself, but too slowly, which to me was code for another reason why it wouldn't be Jim Pugel.
And too piecemeal, which to me was code for another subtle swipe at McGinn. These guys have been swinging at each other during the transition, kind of below the radar for a while.
We're talking over the news of the week with our regular panel of journalists, Eli Sanders, whose voice you last heard, Joni Balter, and Knute Berger. Joni, you alluded, or didn't allude, you mentioned the many panels that the mayor has in 10 days has already formed. There are two police search panels, and as I understand it, they're both headed up by former county executive Ron Sims and immigration rights activist Pramila Jayapal, right? Both committees? It's not one for each committee.
That's what I read as well.
And one is sort of the small working group, and one is a big group?
One is the community input group, and the other is, I think, more like a search committee.
Real search committee.
Well,
you do a search committee, and then you hire a search firm.
Yeah.
But then the committee is working with the search firm.
So I mean, what Ed Murray is doing is, you know, humorous as it can be sometimes when you total up all his committees and the number of people on the committees, is classic Seattle politics, which is what voters said they wanted by electing him. And one of the benefits to Ed Murray when he finally selects a chief is that he will be able to say, we held X number of meetings, right, and 42 people signed off on this, and I reached out to 12 different communities, and everyone is on board. Let's turn the page and move forward.
What does it say, the selection of those two committee chairs?
Well, I think it covers a lot of bases if you think about it. So Ron Sims, you know, has been county executive. He knows the minority communities, and he knows how things work around here. I'm not as familiar with the other committee chair. So
with Pramila Jayapal, she's the founder of
right. She's an immigration and human rights advocate. She was a Murray supporter. Both Sims and Jayapal were, and she's highly respected.
And don't forget, Ron Sims was almost a mayoral candidate himself.
Now, the way things like this can go haywire is if the committees don't stick to the script that Murray is hoping for and there is dissent within the committees or favorites emerge among the candidates. Because remember, last time we did this, we had multiple candidates come to town.
And then they all withdrew.
Right. But
well, the key one withdrew and a couple others, right? Yeah.
But if it goes the way a process like that should go, where not everyone drops out all of a sudden, then you can have committees fracturing. You can have one committee wanting someone and another wanting someone else. You could have all kinds of exciting outcomes.
Well, you know, when it comes to leadership, eventually you're going to have to get a smaller crew. You're going to have to boil this down to, the real challenge is finding a chief who can do the job. And as we know, when we've looked for police chiefs and school board superintendents and, mm-hmm. and things in the past, that's not always easy. It's not cheap either. And I'm not thinking about the chief search, but Crosscut had a story this morning about the cost of police reform so far. The cost of the monitor, the cost of putting in certain reforms already in place. And it's since the reform process started, it's cost the department I think it was $5.5 million
wow.
in reform related expenses, and they've proposed that the department create a new $12 million computer system to track all the things that need to be tracked once everything's up and running. And then that computer system will cost another $1 million a year or so to operate. And so one of the interesting things in sort of rebuilding the police department is there are all these moving parts, oversight committees, the monitor, the feds, mm-hmm. all these things. But eventually you're going to have to end up with a functioning department with a chief who runs it. And gains the confidence of the community, and you're going to have to winnow down the crowd.
Well, so I've just named you three in my head a wish list committee. You know, who should this? What qualities should this new police chief have? Do you think to succeed?
Well, I've heard some of the folks who are involved in this talk about you need somebody who understands a big, complicated, diverse city. Somebody who believes in reform and who can actually enact that and win over enough of the sort of more, well, if this is how it goes, more of the entrenched members while making this change. Ed Murray said he wants things to move kind of quickly. So whoever comes in here, say, April, May, June, has to be able to do all of these things that we're talking about.
Do you imagine there are a lot of candidates who fit that?
Well, actually, you'll be surprised how small the number is. You'll be because not here's another thing. You know, we do everything big old process around here, and so you come to town, and you get to meet the good and the bad and the ugly of the city who have a lot of good questions, and your name is in the press. Now, if you work for another police department, everybody back home finds out that you have a wandering eye.
And that's bad.
I don't know. Sometimes people
you can leverage it into
sometimes,
a raise.
Well, I think that's what the last guy did.
Yeah, the that Sacramento guy.
Yeah, that's what he did.
What do you think, so, Eli? What are you looking for in an ideal candidate?
Someone who has, I think a lot of what Joni said, I might just say it a little bit differently. I mean, someone who has been there and done that in terms of big city policing, someone who is willing to let heads roll, someone who is not intimidated by the entrenched culture at the STPD, but can speak the language of police, you know, or policing, and so kind of fit into that culture but not be of it. And someone, there's this kind of intangible quality, but someone charismatic enough to pull people along with him.
A leader.
Yeah.
Somebody with leader qualities.
Well, in that Ed Murray letter, he reiterated the department is going to be dedicated to community policing, you know, so there's a certain style of policing that's mm-hmm. been laid out as a given. And not only, I think, will this person have to have some experience demonstrating having transformed some traditional police culture somewhere else, they're going to need to be tech savvy. I think many of the advances in policing have to do with how you deploy people, how you keep track of crimes, how you get people to hotspots and that kind of thing. And my sense is that they're going to need somebody not only who can, you know, really gets the technology of modern policing, but then is also apparently going to have to get the technology of the internal tracking that's going to be required of the behavior of your own employees. So I think it's not going to be a traditional donut-chomping, caricature of an old-school cop.
Well,
it's something very different.
You're making it sound like an almost impossible job for one person to take on.
Well, we've said that before about school superintendent, police chief. Some of these jobs do, and that's why they have sort of rapid turnaround.
Right.
Because they are very, you have to be everything. He's talking about the technology. Don't forget, a lot of the officers are now wearing the camera on their lapel or wherever they put on the pocket or something like that.
And the other attribute that we should throw in there, politically savvy. I mean, this is a role where you have to navigate the push and pull between the council and the mayor. You have to please the mayor. You have to please the public. You have to be able to sit before these committees and answer questions. You're not elected, but if the public turns on you, you're in
right.
trouble.
Am I correct that at least two city council members are on one of these committees? I think Tim Burgess was appointed to one, if I'm not mistaken. But I'll have to check that out. Or somebody else will have to.
I'm not certain
out.
If they're on the committees, but it kind of doesn't matter because Bruce Harrell and Tim Burgess are very, very versed in police issues and very, very interested, and they will play a big role, both of them.
Hmm. We're talking about police. Let's move on briefly because after your last visit Friday evening, the vote totals for the local machinist 751. Vote on Boeing's contract extension offer was announced, and by the slimmest of margins, that contract was approved, which means that Boeing will assemble at least its 777X somewhere in Washington State, looks like possibly Pierce County, will get the nod. And it was momentous for so many reasons, but immediately after, and actually beforehand, too, complaints were filed with the National Labor Relations Board challenging the process of the vote and the date of the vote and all those sorts of things. Let's step back a second. What is this approval of this, especially pension change, augur for the labor movement?
Well, I think the many people in the labor movement believe this is a disaster. It's bad. It's going to be tough for other Boeing unions to negotiate on pension issues. It'll have trickle down, I'm sure, in Olympia when people begin, and the Republicans want to discuss this already, dealing with state pensions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a way in which other unions are now put on some kind of notice that the pensions are a target. And because the signal this sends to other companies is you can have one of your best years ever and still get concessions from your unions.
Big ones.
Yeah, huge, huge. So I think for labor, that's a problem. On the other hand, it's a win in the sense that Boeing machinist union workers are going to have jobs for the next, 10, 20, 30 years. I mean, literally a generation's worth of jobs on that project.
It feels like sports, the way that sports politics play out has now come to the regular manufacturing industry. So if you want to call them games or way of doing business, take your pick. But the way that sports teams have been treating cities is now the way that sometimes a big company treats a community. Do these things or else.
A bunch of communities. I know the governor of Alabama was complaining that he'd felt used, and what goes through my head is, really? Are you just
that one coming?
Right. Well, when we're talking about concessions, we should add the concession that the state made to Boeing before the IAM.
You mean the $8 billion in
exactly.
tax cuts?
Right. That happened in a span of 2 weeks, the fastest the legislature has ever moved on anything in recent memory.
The thing that I spoke to Connie Kelleher, who was the spokeswoman for the local 751 for the machinists on Monday, and she said that she felt that the approval had happened due to all the external pressure that the machinists had. Some of the machinists said they wanted jobs, but most of them felt that local politicians led by our governor, Jay Inslee, had unduly pushed on their vote.
Well, take the unduly out for a second and just think, what is the other choice for a governor? Is he really going to, I mean, and he never said, I'm recommending you vote yes, but he all but said that. He just didn't say that. But clearly, a governor is really going to just sit around and twiddle his thumbs and say, however you vote, and geez, it doesn't even matter if you vote. I mean, there's no way that anybody would respect him if he did that. You can totally see where that was coming from.
Yeah, I would add two things. One is that whatever you think of Jay Inslee, this is a win for him.
Totally.
It would have been a devastating political loss as well as, you know, potentially an economic loss for the state. So he won. Was it a pretty win? No, it was an ugly win. Very ugly. But it was a win. He got that Boeing package passed, and the union vote went the way he wanted to.
Hold that thought. Knute Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, I'm Marcy Silman. The Week in Review continues here on KUOW in a minute. You're tuned to KUOW, and as it is Friday morning, this is The Week in Review. Steve Scher is on vacation. I'm Marcy Silman, filling in for him today. And with us, our panel of journalists, Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Stranger, Knute Berger, the Moss back at Crosscut, and news analyst Joni Balter. Here we were talking about Boeing machinists and winning state politics there. Jay Inslee, the winner in the ugly fight, Knute, is that what you called it? It was ugly,
yeah.
But it was a win. Eli, you mentioned the $8 billion tax breaks. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. And to pivot to something else, but to pivot around the Capitol building in Olympia, they are currently down there being told that they need to look for $5 billion over the next 4 years in order to meet their constitutional obligation to just amply fund basic education.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Supreme Court order that relates to the McCleary decision. But it's quite stunning that this state has for years, according to the Supreme Court, been underfunding basic education, just basic public education in this state, which is a constitutional obligation, and didn't meet the obligation last year when they knew they were under court order to do this. But within, you know, a very short period in December, were able to find $8 billion to give to Boeing, and now can't find $5 billion very easily. I'm sure we're gonna spend a lot of time the next few months trying to find this $5 billion to educate people in the state. And by the way, Boeing spends a lot of time complaining about our workforce not being educated enough in the areas that it wants its workers to be educated in.
Well, you're using that term there, that B word, that billion word, and that is a little hard to come by when you've been in a recession for however many years. But I do hear and sort of sense that things are a little rosier down there. So the whole find the money routine will probably be a little easier, but still the magnitude of the amount of money that needs to be found is what we shall be talking about here for low these many months.
Well, there's $5 billion, and there's also Jay Inslee's top priority, which he'll go back to lawmakers with, which is transportation funding.
Yeah.
He couldn't get an agreement on that despite trying to bring everybody together before Christmas. And the latest, perhaps, maybe not nail in the coffin, but something, spike in the heart, is the ongoing revelations about the problems with management, I guess, at Washington State Department of Transportation, WashDOT, that Bertha's stuck on
its pontoons are cracked.
Pontoons are cracked. There's bridges that we can't replace.
The price keeps going up for all
up and up, and the contingency funds for these projects seem spent out. And then there's like who's on the hook for paying for the Bertha cost overruns. And every day that Bertha is quiet, there are other Seattle Department of Transportation related projects that kind of sit around. So there's a lot of sitting around going on.
It's very expensive.
It's really expensive
sitting around.
Speaking of billions,
We don't have the numbers on the Bertha blockage and what that's costing. WashDOT has been very reluctant to give up any specifics on that. Of course, they want to wait until they know what the scope of the problem is and that kind of thing. But if you think about a taxi meter running while you're,
while you
just
wait.
That alone, let alone fixing whatever is down there. They have, I think, the Bertha contingency fund is $40 or $44 million. So they have a pot of money that's specifically designed. I think the head of the Department of Transportation said for running into stuff. That was the direct quote.
Yeah, but the amazing thing in your column is they ran into their own stuff.
Yeah, well, that's where you get into the gang that can't drill straight, type of thing, where apparently all the fantasies we had about what was blocking Bertha, and then it turns out it was stuff pipe they put in the ground, WashDOT put in the ground
and forgot to take out.
So we'll find out what the thing. The other, but then also this week, 520, the 520 project. The Department of Transportation finally gave us numbers on the overages there, and the pontoon debacle is one piece of it, but only a big piece. But
well, they rebuild. They have to rebuild them all, right?
Right. So there were a number of problems with both the manufacture of some of the pontoons, but also the design, which WashDOT did. So we found out that was over $200 million mistake. So they're basically most of the contingency budget's blown. And they've now said they're going to need another $170, $180 million to complete the project to pay for other overages, some of which are specified and some of which are anticipated.
This is the exact wrong climate to go to lawmakers from around the state and say, yeah, all that stuff happened, but you don't mind, just revving up the transportation package so we can borrow and snip and find efficiencies to come on over here and fix all this. And may I just say, I am feeling just a little funny that the tunnel boring machine is named after a woman. I mean, the next thing you're going to hear, Bertha is in a foul mood. I mean, I'm just waiting for that.
Well, Bertha actually has her Twitter account where she does say stuff like that. There's
marvelous.
The anthropomorphizing of a machine is a whole other thing. But, lawmakers go into session next week. They were down in Olympia yesterday with reporters, journalists from around the state. And on the best of times, non-Puget Sound representatives, especially those from east of the Cascades, are not very happy about any spending requests that come their way. Included in that transportation package is an extension of taxing authority for King County for Metro. Don't forget that's a big wish list of Dow Constantine. So it's not just a pie in the sky package that is trying to get passed. It will impact people, and these lawmakers don't like the Democrats from Seattle on a good day.
And the Democrats from Seattle on any day, although many of them won't say this, but they don't like the way that the rest of the state free rides on our tax base. We pay for the bridges in.
Well, Dow Constantine has started saying that.
Yeah, they have.
They down there.
And they have started being more aggressive about saying it. But and maybe it will be very interesting to see actually what Ed Murray says, because one of his arguments for being mayor was that he could help us down in Olympia. So how exactly will he help us with this? That will be interesting to see. But the city may, or the county may, end up having to just go it alone on this.
Well, Ed Murray, as the former House Transportation Chair down in Olympia, does speak transportation. I mean, he knows where all the right people and points are. But don't forget, the could-be overruns here are all occurring in the hated Puget
Seattle?
Sound area.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are definitely overruns on 520, right? The contingency fund is gone.
No, we know for a fact now that the project is almost $200 million over budget, having spent all their contingency money. So we know that it's and people have to keep in mind, they're not even finished with this is just the first half. and they're not even finished with that. The other thing that's in this transportation package is another mega project, which is the west side of 520. If you think Bertha's a quagmire.
Wait. So half of the project, how do you build half a bridge?
Well, what you do is you build a new bridge across Lake Washington, and then when it meets the old bridge, everything narrows down to a very small artery. So you'll be funneling six lanes into four lanes.
The theory is if you build it, the money will come for the West Landing.
Right. And so this was a Christine Gregoire-driven project in terms of coming up with a schedule. She wanted to get this thing approved and get it moving. And then the idea was that with tolling revenues on I-90 and other things, we would be able to. So the second part of that project is in the proposed transportation plan. But because of what's happening with the 520 and Bertha, people are getting skittish about these mega projects. Already the Columbia Crossing project, which didn't even start.
Well, actually, I've heard that Oregon's going to take that on.
Right.
So it may happen.
They'll build it toward us. And,
then it'll stop halfway across the Columbia River.
And then you're halfway in the middle. You go, what's your option? What do you want to do here, folks?
Oh, goodness. We can parachute across the Columbia or water ski or take a little ferry.
It's worth pointing out, Seattle was not clamoring for this tunnel. So for state lawmakers to say, you know, we don't want to fund transportation across the state because Seattle got us into this boondoggle, that's not what happened. The governor, state lawmakers really wanted this tunnel, and the argument was that better transportation infrastructure in Seattle benefits the whole state. So we should just keep that in mind as we're looking at these so-called boondoggles. I'm not setting aside whether they were or were not good decisions, but there's a little bit of selective memory.
Okay, but selective memory as well is that when the voters were asked if they wanted to reverse that decision, they said no to that.
It was not like a unanimous vote or even close to that.
I love it. Let's talk.
60% wanted to go ahead. So, I mean, maybe those 60% should get the bill.
Well, that's a whole other issue.
Do you have an address for that?
Yeah, who's stuck with the cost overruns, especially for Bertha, when it was the state's big steel pipe that it forgot that it left in the ground that the state, you know.
So you're getting into liability, which is going to be very interesting here about that.
I'm not an attorney, so I think I may leave that aside.
And I think for me, this is actually the more reasonable argument that you could make about the transportation financing. We have a Department of Transportation that seems incapable of handling these projects and is making just these incredible self-inflicted errors. So do you want to add more billions to its wallet or...
Well, a lot of those lawmakers say no. We don't trust you.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of the Republican. I mean, there's a lot of Seattle resentment generally among Republicans and Democrats around the state who are outside the city. And there's a certain amount of Schadenfreude going on. You know, people down in Pierce County are snickering. I think the issue of who pays is obviously going to be one that comes down to liability, negotiation, the courts, because provision in the state law will go to court at some point.
Joni actually found it.
I found it. It says any cost in excess of $2,800,000,000 shall be borne by this vagueness by property owners in the Seattle area who benefit from replacement of the existing viaduct with the deep bore tunnel. Say who? Say what?
But you referred to this on the record session with reporters in Olympia yesterday. There was great divergence of opinion about what that language actually means and whether it's enforced.
And Judy Cleburne, who is heading up a transportation committee, said no way, Seattle on the hook. Well, the rest of the state might not like Seattle when it comes to, you know, hands out asking for money. But what they do like, here's the happy turn. They like this football team that's playing down at CenturyLink
Field.
Very
well executed.
Did you like that?
Very
it was a pirouette on the air. In case you haven't opened a copy of the Seattle Times in the last 2 weeks and seen the front page or gone to the website, there's a big football game tomorrow afternoon in apparently thunder and windstorms. And Knute Berger, this is the second round of the playoffs, and you're going to be there.
Yeah, I am. I'm very excited. I went to the opening game of the season, and there was a big thunderstorm, too. So that was interesting.
Did they
win? We won that game. Okay, yes, we beat San Francisco.
So thunder, then, when you're talking about like what kinds of omens augur well for the team, thunder and lightning.
Well, they're going to have seismic monitors down there because of the thundering feet and the 12th man roar.
So the crowd noise plus the thunder. I wonder what that registers on those seismic things that they're putting throughout there. That's going to be.
Got to be good.
If you timed it right, well, my gosh.
Well, this is a team from the South that's used to playing inside. The New Orleans Saints play in a dome, I believe. The dome that we saw when Katrina hit, full of refugees. So they're not used to wind and rain, perhaps, outside. Playing football. I don't know. I have no idea. We've been asking folks all week on the record about their sports superstitions. You know, there's people who only eat certain foods. There's people who don't wash before games or when there's a big run-up, and people who don't shave. And LiveWire host Luke Burbank, you have a superstition, I understand.
Well, earlier this year, I went on eBay and I bought a really ugly 1980s Seahawks sweater that's called dead stock, which means they're not making them anymore.
What does it look like?
It's white. It's really bulky. It is made of the most synthetic material. Basically, if this sweater was buried below Seattle, Big Bertha would not be able to tunnel through whatever the material is.
Is but that this, sweater or a replica buried beneath Seattle?
No.
It may be.
It's on your back.
Nobody told me I wasn't supposed to leave that sweater underground.
So what did you pay for it? You were going to tell us, and I interrupted you.
I paid like $160 for
Luke!
It.
Luke! Oh, my gosh.
Well, I've got that podcast money now, Marcia, okay. So I'm really rolling in it. Here's the thing, though. I wore the sweater, and they won, and so now it's the lucky sweater, but it is so unflattering. I probably look about 15 pounds heavier when wearing it. I sweat like a stuck pig. It is the worst thing ever, but I daren't not wear it.
Have you posted a picture of yourself in this sweater? I'd love to find one and spread it virally over
the
internet.
I will send you one.
Please do.
Need a break from the pictures of my puppy that I've been posting, which is my current obsession. So I'll take a picture and send it to you guys. You can put it on the Week in Review Facebook page.
We will definitely do that. So where will you be wearing this white garment tomorrow?
I have a friend who's got a production company called Uncle Bob that's up on Capitol Hill, and they have this really great loft where they work, but also they have a projection screen, and because they make TV commercials and things like that, they have the best setup ever. So we're going to be watching the game in, you know, like Marshawn Lynch will be larger than the actual Marshawn Lynch.
You'll be looking down his nostril. I get it.
Yeah, precisely.
Have you got bets out on the game, Luke?
I have some sort of
gentlemen bet, of course.
Gentlemen bet. Nothing. If they allowed sports betting in this state, I would not be able to afford the $160 I spent on the sweater
because I
would constantly be betting on these games. Thankfully, they don't. They protect me from myself, so all my bets are very small potatoes.
Do you have any predictions?
Well, you know, I actually think the Seahawks are going to wallop them, and it has to do with the idea that everybody, because we walloped the Saints, and Marcia, you were absolutely right on two things. First of all, your knowledge of It's a Wonderful Life, your total recall on that was very impressive. as far as the
Harry,
you know,
and
the,
George,
yeah,
Bailey,
the,
oh good.
The age distribution of the Bailey family. The second thing is you're also right about Drew Brees, the quarterback for the Saints. He is not a guy who has a particularly strong arm. He's a really good quarterback, but he's not known for his strength of arm. So if it is windy, that will probably affect him. And then last but not least, you know, we beat the Saints really badly on Monday Night Football. So everybody thinks that now almost everything is somehow going to be different because the Saints have learned their lesson and we're overconfident. I have this weird feeling that we're going to win handily yet again. So that's my prediction.
Luke Burbank, it's good. Your football knowledge, I know, surpasses all. He'll be wearing the ugly white garment tomorrow and cheering on the Seahawks. You can hear Luke tonight on LiveWire, 8 o'clock here on KUOW. Thanks, Luke.
Thanks. Go Seahawks.
I should say that Seattle Times sports writer Jerry Brewer told me yesterday he was in taping an interview with Ross Reynolds that's going to run during the record starting at noon today. And he believes, as with Luke, that the Seahawks will win and it's going to come to a face-off with the San Francisco Giants. and
49ers.
I'm 49ers, right? See, I don't even know this, but I do know that it's going to be windy and rainy, and I hope you'll be wearing protective clothing, Knut.
Yeah, well, I'm going to do my best to stay dry and keep my garlic fries dry.
Oh, well.
Well, I didn't know they sold those at CenturyLink. Knut Berger, Mossback at Crosscut.com. Eli Sanders, Associate Editor at The Stranger. Joni Balter, News Analyst par excellence. The Week in Review is produced by Andy Hirst. Bernard Willetzi, Engineer. The usual host, Steve Scher, enjoying milder weather than we are, I'm sure. I'm Marcy Silman in his place, and this is KUOW Seattle.